Chapter 7. After breakfast, Emily Brent had suggested to Vera Claythorne that they should walk to the summit again and watch for the boat. Vera had acquiesced. The wind had freshened. Small white crests were appearing on the sea. There were no fishing boats out, no sign of the motorboat. The actual village of Sticklehaven could not be seen, only the hill above it, a jutting-out cliff of red rock, concealed the actual little bay. Emily Brent said, "The man who brought us out yesterday seemed a dependable sort of person. It is really very odd that he should be so late this morning." Vera did not answer. She was fighting down a rising feeling of panic. She said to herself, angrily, "You must keep cool. This isn't like you. You've always had excellent nerves." Aloud, she said after a minute or two, "I wish he would come. I want to get away." Emily Brent said dryly, "I've no doubt we all do." Vera said, "It's all so extraordinary. There seems no meaning in it all." The elderly woman beside her said briskly, "I'm very annoyed with myself for being so easily taken in. Really, that letter is absurd when one comes to examine it. But I had no doubts at the time. None at all." Vera murmured mechanically, "I suppose not." "One takes things for granted too much," said Emily Brent. Vera drew a deep, shuddering breath. She said, "Do you really think what you said at breakfast?" "Be a little more precise, my dear. To what in particular are you referring?" Vera said in a low voice, "Do you really think that Rogers and his wife did away with that old lady?" Emily Brent gazed thoughtfully out to sea. Then she said, "Personally, I am quite sure of it. What do you think?"
"I don't know what to think."
Emily Brent said, "Everything goes to support the idea. The way the woman fainted, and the man dropped the coffee tray, remember? Then the way he spoke about it, it didn't ring true. Oh yes, I'm afraid they did it."
Vera said, "The way she looked, scared of her own shadow. I've never seen a woman look so frightened. She must have always been haunted by it."
Miss Brent murmured, "I remember a text that hung in my nursery as a child. Be sure thy sin will find thee out. It's very true, that. Be sure thy sin will find thee out."
Vera scrambled to her feet. She said, "But Miss Brent, in that case..."
"Yes, my dear?"
"The others. What about the others?"
"I don't quite understand you."
"All the other accusations, they weren't true. But if it's true about the Rogerses..."
She stopped, unable to make her chaotic thought clear. Emily Brent's brow, which had been frowning perplexedly, cleared. She said, "Ah, I understand you now. Well, there is that Mr. Lombard. He admits to having abandoned 20 men to their deaths."
Vera said, "They were only natives."
Emily Brent said sharply, "Black or white, they are our brothers."
Vera thought, our black brothers. Oh, I'm going to laugh. I'm hysterical. I'm not myself.
Emily Brent continued thoughtfully, "Of course, some of the other accusations were very far-fetched and ridiculous. Against the judge, for instance, who was only doing his duty in his public capacity, and the ex-Scotland Yard man. My own case, too."
She paused and then went on.
"Naturally, considering the circumstances, I was not going to say anything last night. It was not a fit subject to discuss before gentlemen."
"No?"
Vera listened with interest. Miss Brent continued serenely, "Beatrice Taylor was in service with me. Not a nice girl, as I found out too late. I was very much deceived in her. She had nice manners and was very clean and willing. I was very pleased with her. Of course, all that was the sheerest hypocrisy. She was a loose girl with no morals. Disgusting. It was some time before I found out that she was what they call... in trouble."
She paused. her delicate nose wrinkling itself in distaste. It was a great shock to me. Her parents were decent folk, too, who had brought her up very strictly. I'm glad to say they did not condone her behavior.
Vera said, staring at Miss Brent. What happened?
Naturally, I did not keep her an hour under my roof. No one shall ever say that I condoned immorality.
Vera said in a lower voice, What happened to her? Miss Brent said,
The abandoned creature, not content with having one sin on her conscience, committed a still graver sin. She took her own life.
Vera whispered, horror-struck.
She killed herself.
Yes. She threw herself into the river.
Vera shivered. She stared at the calm, delicate profile of Miss Brent. She said, What did you feel like when you knew she'd done that? Weren't you sorry? Didn't you blame yourself? Emily Brent drew herself up.
I had nothing with which to reproach myself.
Vera said, But if your hardness drove her to it... Emily Brent said sharply,
Her own action, her own sin, that was what drove her to it. If she had behaved like a decent, modest young woman, none of this would have happened.
She turned her face to Vera. There was no self-reproach, no uneasiness in those eyes. They were hard and self-righteous. Emily Brent sat on the summit of Soldier Island, encased in her own armor of virtue. The little elderly spinster was no longer slightly ridiculous to Vera. Suddenly, she was terrible. Dr. Armstrong came out of the dining room and once more came out on the terrace. The judge was sitting in a chair now, gazing placidly out to sea. Lombard and Bloor were over to the left, smoking but not talking. As before, the doctor hesitated for a moment. His eye rested speculatively on Mr. Justice Wargrave. He wanted to consult with someone. He was conscious of the judge's acute logical brain, but nevertheless he wavered. Mr. Justice Wargrave might have a good brain, but he was an elderly man. At this juncture, Armstrong felt what was needed was a man of action. He made up his mind. Lombard, can I speak to you for a minute? Philip started.
Of course.
The two men left the terrace. They strolled down the slope towards the water. When they were out of earshot, Armstrong said, I want a consultation. Lombard's eyebrows went up. He said,
My dear fellow, I've no medical knowledge.
No, I mean as to the general situation.
Oh, that's different.
Armstrong said, Frankly, what do you think of the position? Lombard reflected a minute. Then he said,
It's rather suggestive, isn't it?
What are your ideas on the subject of that woman? Do you accept Bloor's theory?
Philip puffed smoke into the air. He said, It's perfectly feasible, taken alone.
Exactly. Armstrong's tone sounded relieved. Philip Lombard was no fool.
The latter went on, That is, accepting the premise that Mr. and Mrs. Rogers have successfully got away with murder in their time, and I don't see why they shouldn't. What do you think they did exactly, poisoned the old lady?
Armstrong said slowly, It might be simpler than that. I asked Rogers this morning what this Miss Brady had suffered from. His answer was enlightening. I don't need to go into medical details, but in a certain form of cardiac trouble, amyl nitrate is used. When an attack comes on, an ampoule of amyl nitrate is broken and it is inhaled. If amyl nitrate were withheld, well, the consequences might easily be fatal.
Philip Lombard said thoughtfully, As simple as that. It must have been rather tempting.
The doctor nodded. Yes, no positive action. No arsenic to obtain and administer, nothing definite, just negation. And Rogers hurried through the night to fetch a doctor, and they both felt confident that no one could ever know.
And even if anyone knew, nothing could ever be proved against them, added Philip Lombard. He frowned suddenly.
Of course, that explains a good deal.
Armstrong said, puzzled, I beg your pardon. Lombard said, I mean, it explains Soldier Island. There are crimes that cannot be brought home to their perpetrators. Instance, the Rogerses. Another instance, old Wargrave, who committed his murder strictly within the law. Armstrong said sharply, You believe that story? Philip Lombard smiled. Oh, yes, I believe it. Wargrave murdered Edward Seaton, all right. Murdered him as surely as if he'd stuck a stiletto through him. But he was clever enough to do it from the judge's seat in wig and gown. So, in the ordinary way, you can't bring his little crime home to him. A sudden flash passed like lightning through Armstrong's mind. Murder in hospital. Murder on the operating table. Safe, yes. Safe as houses. Philip Lombard was saying, Hence, Mr. Owen. Hence, Soldier Island. Armstrong drew a deep breath. Now we're getting down to it. What's the real purpose of getting us all here? Philip Lombard said, What do you think? Armstrong said abruptly, Let's go back a minute to this woman's death. What are the possible theories? Rogers killed her because he was afraid she would give the show away. Second possibility, she lost her nerve and took an easy way out herself. Philip Lombard said, Suicide, eh? What do you say to that? Lombard said, It could have been, yes, if it hadn't been for Marston's death. Two suicides within 12 hours is a little too much to swallow. And if you tell me that Anthony Marston, a young bull with no nerves and precious little brains, got the wind up over having mowed down a couple of kids and deliberately put himself out of the way, well, the idea is laughable. And anyway, how did he get hold of this stuff? From all I've ever heard, potassium cyanide isn't the kind of stuff you take about with you in your waistcoat pocket. But that's your line of country. Armstrong said, Nobody in their senses carries potassium cyanide. It might be done by someone who is going to take a wasp's nest. The ardent gardener, or landowner, in fact. Again, not Anthony Marston. It strikes me that that cyanide is going to need a bit of explaining. Either Anthony Marston meant to do away with himself before he came here, and therefore came prepared, or else... Armstrong prompted him. Or else? Philip Lombard grinned. Why make me say it, when it's on the tip of your own tongue? Anthony Marston was murdered, of course. Dr. Armstrong drew a deep breath. And Mrs. Rogers? Lombard said slowly, I could believe in Anthony's suicide, with difficulty, if it weren't for Mrs. Rogers. I could believe in Mrs. Rogers' suicide easily, if it weren't for Anthony Marston. I can believe that Rogers put his wife out of the way, if it were not for the unexpected death of Anthony Marston. But what we need is a theory to explain two deaths following rapidly on each other. Armstrong said, I can perhaps give you some help towards that theory. And he repeated the facts that Rogers had given him about the disappearance of the two little china figures. Lombard said, Yes, little china figures. There were certainly 10 last night at dinner, and now there are 8, you say. Dr. Armstrong recited, 10 little soldier boys going out to dine. One went and choked himself, and then there were 9. 9 little soldier boys sat up very late. One overslept himself, and then there were 8. The two men looked at each other. Philip Lombard grinned and flung away his cigarette. Fits too damn well to be a coincidence. Anthony Marston dies of asphyxiation, or choking last night after dinner, and Mother Rogers oversleeps herself with a vengeance. And therefore, said Armstrong. Lombard took him up. And therefore, another kind of soldier, the unknown soldier, X, Mr. Owen, U.N. Owen, one unknown lunatic at large. Ah, Armstrong breathed a sigh of relief. You agree. But you see what it involves. Rogers swore that there was no one but ourselves and he and his wife on the island. Rogers is wrong, or possibly Rogers is lying. Armstrong shook his head. I don't think he's lying. The man's scared. He's scared nearly out of his senses. Philip Lombard nodded. He said, No motorboat this morning. That fits in. Mr. Owen's little arrangements again to the fore. Soldier Island is to be isolated until Mr. Owen has finished his job.
Armstrong had gone pale. He said, You realize the man must be a raving maniac.
Philip Lombard said, and there was a new ring in his voice, There's one thing Mr. Owen didn't realize.
What's that?
This island's more or less a bare rock. We shall make short work of searching it. We'll soon ferret out U.N. Owen, Esquire.
Dr. Armstrong said warningly, He'll be dangerous.
Philip Lombard laughed. Dangerous? Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? I'll be dangerous when I get hold of him.
He paused and said, We'd better rope in Blore to help us.
He'll be a good man in a pinch. Better not tell the women. As for the others, the General's gaga, I think, and old Wargrave's forte is masterly inactivity. The three of us can attend to this job.
Chapter 8 Blore was easily roped in. He expressed immediate agreement with their arguments.
What you said about those China figures, sir, makes all the difference. That's crazy, that is. There's only one thing. You don't think this Owen's idea might be to do the job by proxy, as it were?
Explain yourself, man.
Well, I mean like this. After the racket last night, this young Marston gets the wind up and poisons himself. And Rogers, he gets the wind up too and bumps off his wife, all according to UNO's plan.
Armstrong shook his head. He stressed the point about the cyanide.
Blore agreed. Yes, I'd forgotten that. Not a natural thing to be carrying about with you. But how did it get into his drink, sir?
Lombard said, I've been thinking about that.
Marston had several drinks that night. Between the time he had his last one and the time he finished the one before it, there was quite a gap. During that time, his glass was lying about on some table or other. I think, though I can't be sure, it was on the little table near the window. The window was open. Somebody could have slipped a dose of the cyanide into the glass.
Blore said unbelievingly,
Without our all seeing him, sir.
Lombard said dryly,
We were all rather concerned elsewhere.
Armstrong said slowly, That's true. We'd all been attacked. We were walking about, moving about the room, arguing, indignant, intent on our own business. I think it could have been done.
Blore shrugged his shoulders. Fact is, it must have been done. Now then, gentlemen, let's make a start. Nobody's got a revolver by any chance. I suppose that's too much to hope for.
Lombard said, I've got one. He patted his pocket. Blore's eyes opened very wide. He said in an over-casual tone,
Always carry that about with you, sir.
Lombard said, Usually.
I've been in some tight places, you know.
Oh, said Blore, and added,
Well, you've probably never been in a tighter place than you are today. If there's a lunatic hiding on this island, he's probably got a young arsenal on him, to say nothing of a knife or dagger or two.
Armstrong coughed.
You may be wrong there, Blore. Many homicidal lunatics are very quiet, unassuming people. Delightful fellows.
Blore said, I don't feel this one is going to be of that kind, Dr. Armstrong.
The three men started on their tour of the island. It proved unexpectedly simple. On the northwest side, towards the coast, the cliffs fell sheer to the sea below, their surface unbroken. On the rest of the island, there were no trees and very little cover. The three men worked carefully and methodically, beating up and down from the highest point to the water's edge, narrowly scanning the least irregularity in the rock which might point to the entrance to a cave. But there were no caves. They came at last, skirting the water's edge, to where General MacArthur sat looking out to sea. It was very peaceful here, with the lap of the waves breaking over the rocks. The old man sat very upright, his eyes fixed on the horizon. He paid no attention to the approach of the searchers. His oblivion of them made one, at least, faintly uncomfortable. Blore thought to himself, "'Tis unnatural. Looks as though he's gone into a trance or something." He cleared his throat and said in a would-be conversational tone,
"'Nice peaceful spot you've found for yourself, sir.'
The general frowned. He cast a quick look over his shoulder. He said,
"'There is so little time. So little time. I really must insist that no one disturbs me.'
Blore said genially,
"'We won't disturb you. We're just making a tour of the island, so to speak. Just wondered, you know, if someone might be hiding on it.
The general frowned and said,
You don't understand. You don't understand at all. Please, go away.
Blore retreated. He said as he joined the other two, He's crazy. It's no good talking to him.
Lombard asked with some curiosity, What did he say?
Blore shrugged his shoulders.
Something about there being no time and that he didn't want to be disturbed.
Dr. Armstrong frowned. He murmured, I wonder now. The search of the island was practically completed. The three men stood on the highest point, looking over towards the mainland. There were no boats out. The wind was freshening.
Lombard said, No fishing boats out. There's a storm coming. Damned nuisance you can't see the village from here. We could signal or do something.
Blore said, We might light a bonfire tonight. Lombard said, frowning,
The devil of it is that that's all probably been provided for.
In what way, sir?
How do I know? Practical joke, perhaps.
We're to be marooned here. No attention is to be paid to signals, etc.
Possibly the village has been told there's a wager on. Some damn fool story, anyway.
Blore said dubiously,
Think they'd swallow that?
Lombard said dryly,
It's easier of belief than the truth. If the village were told that the island was to be isolated until Mr. Unknown Owen had quietly murdered all his guests, do you think they'd believe that?
Dr. Armstrong said, There are moments when I can't believe it myself, and yet... Philip Lombard, his lips curling back from his teeth, said,
And yet, that's just it. You've said it, Doctor.
Blore was gazing down into the water. He said,
Nobody could have clambered down here, I suppose.
Armstrong shook his head. I doubt it. It's pretty sheer. And where could he hide?
Blore said, There might be a hole in the cliff. If we had a boat now, we could row round the island.
Lombard said,
If we had a boat, we'd all be halfway to the mainland by now.
True enough, sir.
Lombard said suddenly, We can make sure of this cliff. There's only one place where there could be a recess, just a little to the right below here. If you fellows can get hold of a rope, you can let me down to make sure.
Blore said, Might as well be sure, though it seems absurd on the face of it. I'll see if I can get hold of something. He started off briskly down to the house.
Lombard stared up at the sky. The clouds were beginning to mass themselves together. The wind was increasing.
He shot a sideways look at Armstrong. He said,
You're very silent, Doctor. What are you thinking?
Armstrong said slowly, I was wondering exactly how mad old MacArthur was. Vera had been restless all the morning. She had avoided Emily Brent with a kind of shuddering aversion. Miss Brent herself had taken a chair just round the corner of the house so as to be out of the wind. She sat there knitting. Every time Vera thought of her, she seemed to see a pale, drowned face with seaweed entangled in the hair, a face that had once been pretty, impudently pretty, perhaps, and which was now beyond the reach of pity or terror. And Emily Brent, placid and righteous, sat knitting. On the main terrace, Mr. Justice Wargrave sat huddled in a porter's chair. His head was poked down well into his neck. When Vera looked at him, she saw a man standing in the dock, a young man with fair hair and blue eyes and a bewildered, frightened face. Edward Seaton. And in imagination, she saw the judge's old hands put the black cap on his head and begin to pronounce sentence. After a while, Vera strolled slowly down to the sea. She walked along towards the extreme end of the island, where an old man sat staring out to the horizon. General MacArthur stirred at her approach, his head turned. There was a queer mixture of questioning and apprehension in his look. It startled her. He stared intently at her for a minute or two. She thought to herself, How queer. It's almost as though he knew. He said,
Ah, it's you. You've come.
Vera sat down beside him. She said, Do you like sitting here looking out to sea? He nodded his head gently.
Yes,
he said.
It's pleasant. It's a good place, I think, to wait.
To wait, said Vera sharply. What are you waiting for? He said gently,
The end. But I think you know that, don't you? It's true, isn't it? We're all waiting for the end.
She said unsteadily, What do you mean? General MacArthur said gravely,
None of us are going to leave the island. That's the plan. You know it, of course, perfectly. What perhaps you can't understand is the relief.
Vera said wonderingly, The relief? He said,
Yes, of course, you're very young. You haven't got to that yet. But it does come. The blessed relief when you know that you've done with it all. That you haven't got to carry the burden any longer. You'll feel that too some day.
Vera said hoarsely, I don't understand you. Her fingers worked spasmodically. She felt suddenly afraid of this quiet old soldier. He said musingly,
You see, I loved Leslie. I loved her very much.
Vera said questioningly, Was Leslie your wife?
Yes, my wife. I loved her. And I was very proud of her. She was so pretty. So gay.
He was silent for a minute or two. Then he said,
Yes, I loved Leslie. That's why I did it.
Vera said,
You mean?
And paused. General MacArthur nodded his head gently.
It's not much good denying it now. Not when we're all going to die. I sent Richmond to his death. I suppose in a way it was murder. Curious. Murder, and I've always been such a law-abiding man. But it didn't seem like that at the time. I had no regrets. Served him damn well right, that's what I thought. But afterwards...
In a hard voice, Vera said,
Well, afterwards?
He shook his head vaguely. He looked puzzled and a little distressed.
I don't know. I don't know. It was all different, you see. I don't know if Leslie ever guessed. I don't think so. But, you see, I didn't know about her anymore. She'd gone far away where I couldn't reach her. And then she died. And I was alone.
Vera said, Alone. Alone. And the echo of her voice came back to her from the rocks. General MacArthur said,
You'll be glad too, when the end comes.
Vera got up. She said sharply, I don't know what you mean. He said,
I know, my child. I know.
You don't. You don't understand at all.
General MacArthur looked out to sea again. He seemed unconscious of her presence behind him. He said very gently and softly,
Leslie.
When Bloor returned from the house with a rope coiled over his arm, he found Armstrong where he had left him, staring down into the depths. Bloor said breathlessly,
Where's Mr. Lombard?
Armstrong said carelessly, Gone to test some theory or other. He'll be back in a minute. Look here, Bloor, I'm worried.
I should say we're all worried.
The doctor waved an impatient hand. Of course, I don't mean it that way. I'm thinking of old MacArthur.
What about him, sir?
Dr. Armstrong said grimly,
What we're looking for is a madman. What price MacArthur?
Bloor said incredulously,
You mean he's homicidal?
Armstrong said doubtfully, I shouldn't have said so, not for a minute. But of course I'm not a specialist in mental diseases. I haven't really had any conversation with him. I haven't studied him from that point of view.
Bloor said doubtfully, Gaga, yes, but I wouldn't have said...
Armstrong cut in with a slight effort as of a man who pulls himself together.
You're probably right. Damn it all, there must be someone hiding on the island. Ah, here comes Lombard.
They fastened the rope carefully. Lombard said... I'll help myself all I can. Keep a lookout for a sudden strain on the rope. After a minute or two, while they stood together watching Lombard's progress, Bloor said,
Climbs like a cat, doesn't he?
There was something odd in his voice. Dr. Armstrong said,
I should think he must have done some mountaineering in his time.
Maybe.
There was a silence, and the ex-inspector said,
Funny sort of cove altogether.
Do you know what I think?
What?
He's a wrong'un. Armstrong said doubtfully, in what way? Blaw grunted. Then he said, I don't know, exactly. But I wouldn't trust him a yard.
Dr. Armstrong said, I suppose he's led an adventurous life.
Blaw said, I bet some of his adventures have had to be kept pretty dark. He paused and then went on. Did you happen to bring a revolver along with you, Doctor?
Armstrong stared. Me? Good Lord, no. Why should I?
Blaw said, why did Mr. Lombard?
Armstrong said doubtfully, I suppose, habit.
Blaw snorted.
A sudden pull came on the rope. For some moments they had their hands full. Presently, when the strain relaxed, Blaw said,
there are habits and habits. Mr. Lombard takes a revolver to out-of-the-way places, right enough, and a Primus, and a sleeping bag, and a supply of bug powder, no doubt. But habit wouldn't make him bring the whole outfit down here. It's only in books people carry revolvers around as a matter of course.
Dr. Armstrong shook his head perplexedly. They leaned over and watched Lombard's progress. His search was thorough, and they could see at once that it was futile. Presently he came up over the edge of the cliff. He wiped the perspiration from his forehead.
Well, he said, we're up against it. It's the house or nowhere.
The house was easily searched. They went through the few outbuildings first and then turned their attention to the building itself. Mrs. Rogers' yard measure discovered in the kitchen dresser assisted them, but there were no hidden spaces left unaccounted for. Everything was plain and straightforward, a modern structure devoid of concealment. They went through the ground floor first. As they mounted to the bedroom floor, they saw through the landing window Rogers carrying out a tray of cocktails to the terrace. Philip Lombard said lightly,
wonderful animal, the good servant. Carries on with an impassive countenance.
Armstrong said appreciatively, Rogers is a first-class butler, I'll say that for him.
Blaw said, his wife was a pretty good cook, too. That dinner last night.
They turned into the first bedroom. 5 minutes later, they faced each other on the landing. No one hiding, no possible hiding place.
Blaw said, there's a little stair here.
Dr. Armstrong said, it leads up to the servants' room.
Blaw said, there must be a place under the roof, a cisterns, water tank, etc. It's the best chance and the only one.
And it was then, as they stood there, that they heard the sound from above. A soft, furtive footfall overhead. They all heard it. Armstrong grasped Blaw's arm. Lombard held up an admonitory finger.
Quiet. Listen.
It came again. Someone moving softly, furtively overhead. Armstrong whispered, he's actually in the bedroom itself. The room where Mrs. Rogers' body is.
Blaw whispered back, of course. Best hiding place he could have chosen. Nobody likely to go there. Now then, quiet as you can.
They crept stealthily upstairs. On the little landing outside the door of the bedroom, they paused again. Yes, someone was in the room. There was a faint creak from within.
Blaw whispered, now!
He flung open the door and rushed in, the other two close behind him. Then all three stopped dead. Rogers was in the room, his hands full of garments. Blaw recovered himself first. He said,
sorry, Rogers. Heard someone moving about in here and thought, well...
He stopped. Rogers said,
I'm sorry, gentlemen, I was just moving my things. I take it there will be no objection if I take one of the vacant guest chambers on the floor below, the smallest room.
It was to Armstrong that he spoke, and Armstrong replied, of course, get on with it. He avoided looking at the sheeted figure lying on the bed. Rogers said, thank you, sir. He went out of the room with his arm full of belongings and went down the stairs to the floor below. Armstrong moved over to the bed and, lifting the sheet, looked down on the peaceful face of the dead woman. There was no fear there now, just emptiness. Armstrong said,
wish I'd got my stuff here. I'd like to know what drug it was.
Then he turned to the other two. Let's get finished. I feel it in my bones, we're not going to find anything. Blore was wrestling with the bolts of a low manhole. He said, That chap moves damn quietly. A minute or two ago we saw him in the garden. None of us heard him come upstairs. Lombard said, I suppose that's why we assumed it must be a stranger moving about up here. Blore disappeared into a cavernous darkness. Lombard pulled a torch from his pocket and followed. 5 minutes later, three men stood on an upper landing and looked at each other. They were dirty and festooned with cobwebs, and their faces were grim. There was no one on the island but their eight selves. Chapter 9. Lombard said slowly, So we've been wrong. Wrong all along. Built up a nightmare of superstition and fantasy all because of the coincidence of two deaths. Armstrong said gravely, And yet, you know, the argument holds. Hang it all, I'm a doctor. I know something about suicides. Anthony Marston wasn't a suicidal type. Lombard said doubtfully, It couldn't, I suppose, have been an accident. Blore snorted, unconvinced. Damn queer sort of accident, he grunted. There was a pause. Then Blore said, About the woman, and stopped. Mrs. Rogers. Yes. It's possible, isn't it, that that might have been an accident? Philip Lombard said, An accident? In what way? Blore looked slightly embarrassed. His red brick face grew a little deeper in hue. He said, almost blurting out the words, Look here, Doctor, you did give her some dope, you know. Armstrong stared at him. Dope? What do you mean? Last night. You said yourself you'd given her something to make her sleep. Oh, that, yes, a harmless sedative. What was it exactly? I gave her a mild dose of Trionol, a perfectly harmless preparation. Blore grew redder still. He said, Look here, not to mince matters. You didn't give her an overdose, did you? Dr. Armstrong said angrily, I don't know what you mean. Blore said, It's possible, isn't it, that you may have made a mistake? These things do happen once in a while. Armstrong said sharply, I did nothing of the sort. The suggestion is ridiculous. He stopped and added in a cold, biting tone, Or do you suggest that I gave her an overdose on purpose? Philip Lombard said quickly, Look here, you two. Got to keep our heads. Don't let's start slinging accusations about. Blore said sullenly, I only suggested the doctor had made a mistake. Dr. Armstrong smiled with an effort. He said, showing his teeth in a somewhat mirthless smile, Doctors can't afford to make mistakes of that kind, my friend. Blore said deliberately, It wouldn't be the first you've made, if that gramophone record is to be believed. Armstrong went white. Philip Lombard said quickly and angrily to Blore, What's the sense of making yourself offensive? We're all in the same boat, we've got to pull together. What about your own pretty little spot of perjury? Blore took a step forward, his hands clenched. He said in a thick voice, Perjury be damned. That's a foul lie. You may try and shut me up, Mr. Lombard, but there's things I want to know, and one of them is about you. Lombard's eyebrows rose. About me? Yes. I want to know why you've brought a revolver down here on a pleasant social visit. Lombard said, You do you? Yes, I do, Mr. Lombard. Lombard said unexpectedly, You know, Blore, you're not nearly such a fool as you look. That's as may be. What about that revolver? Lombard smiled. I brought it because I expected to run into a spot of trouble. Blore said suspiciously, You didn't tell us that last night. Lombard shook his head. You were holding out on us, Blore persisted. In a way, yes. Said Lombard. Well, come on out with it. Lombard said slowly, I allowed you all to think that I was asked here in the same way as most of the others. That's not quite true. As a matter of fact, I was approached by a little Jew boy, Morris his name was. He offered me 100 guineas to come down here and keep my eyes open. Said I'd got a reputation for being a good man in a tight place. Well? Blore prompted impatiently. Lombard said with a grin, That's all. Dr. Armstrong said, But surely he told you more than that. Oh, no, he didn't.
Just shut up like a clam. I could take it or leave it, those were his words. I was hard up, I took it.
Blore looked unconvinced. He said, "Why didn't you tell us all this last night?"
"My dear man," Lombard shrugged eloquent shoulders, "how was I to know that last night wasn't exactly the eventuality I was here to cope with? I lay low and told a non-committal story."
Dr. Armstrong said shrewdly, "But now you think differently." Lombard's face changed. It darkened and hardened. He said,
"Yes. I believe now that I'm in the same boat as the rest of you. That 100 guineas was just Mr. Owen's little bit of cheese to get me into the trap along with the rest of you."
He said slowly,
"For we are in a trap. I'll take my oath on that. Mrs. Rogers' death, Tony Marston's, the disappearing soldier boys on the dinner table. Oh, yes, Mr. Owen's hand is plainly seen. But where the devil is Mr. Owen himself?"
Downstairs, the gong pealed a solemn call to lunch. Rogers was standing by the dining room door. As the three men descended the stairs, he moved a step or two forward. He said in a low, anxious voice, "I hope lunch will be satisfactory. There is cold ham and cold tongue, and I've boiled some potatoes, and there's cheese and biscuits and some tinned fruit."
Lombard said, "Sounds all right. Stores are holding out, then."
"There is plenty of food, sir, of a tinned variety. The larder is very well stocked. A necessity, that, I should say, sir, on an island where one may be cut off from the mainland for a considerable period."
Lombard nodded.
Rogers murmured as he followed the three men into the dining room,
"It worries me that Fred Narracott hasn't been over today. It's peculiarly unfortunate, as you might say."
"Yes," said Lombard. "Peculiarly unfortunate describes it very well."
Miss Brent came into the room. She had just dropped a ball of wool and was carefully rewinding the end of it. As she took her seat at table, she remarked,
"The weather is changing. The wind is quite strong, and there are white horses on the sea."
Mr. Justice Wargrave came in. He walked with a slow, measured tread. He darted quick looks from under his bushy eyebrows at the other occupants of the dining room. He said,
"You have had an active morning."
There was a faint, malicious pleasure in his voice. Vera Claythorne hurried in. She was a little out of breath. She said quickly,
"I hope you didn't wait for me. Am I late?"
Emily Brent said,
"You're not the last. The General isn't here yet."
They sat round the table. Rogers addressed Miss Brent.
"Will you begin, madam, or will you wait?"
Vera said, "General MacArthur is sitting right down by the sea. I don't expect he would hear the gong there anyway." She hesitated.
"He's a little vague today, I think."
Rogers said quickly,
"I will go down and inform him luncheon is ready."
Dr. Armstrong jumped up. "I'll go," he said. "You others start lunch." He left the room. Behind him he heard Rogers' voice.
"Will you take cold tongue or cold ham, madam?"
The five people sitting round the table seemed to find conversation difficult. Outside, sudden gusts of wind came up and died away. Vera shivered a little and said,
"There is a storm coming."
Blore made a contribution to the discourse. He said conversationally,
"There was an old fellow in the train from Plymouth yesterday. He kept saying a storm was coming. Wonderful how they know weather, these old salts."
Rogers went round the table collecting the meat plates. Suddenly, with the plates held in his hands, he stopped. He said in an odd, scared voice,
"There's somebody running."
They could all hear it. Running feet along the terrace. In that minute they knew without being told. As by common accord, they all rose to their feet. They stood looking towards the door. Dr. Armstrong appeared, his breath coming fast. He said,
"General MacArthur! Dead!"
The word burst from Vera explosively. Armstrong said,
"Yes, he's dead."
There was a pause. A long pause. Seven people looked at each other and could find no words to say. The storm broke just as the old man's body was borne in through the door. The others were standing in the hall. There was a sudden hiss and roar as the rain came down. As Bloor and Armstrong passed up the stairs with their burden, Vera Claythorne turned suddenly and went into the deserted dining room. It was as they had left it. The sweet course stood ready on the sideboard, untasted. Vera went up to the table. She was there a minute or two later when Rogers came softly into the room. He started when he saw her. Then his eyes asked a question. He said, "Oh, miss, I just came to see." In a loud, harsh voice that surprised herself, Vera said, "You're quite right, Rogers. Look for yourself. There are only 7. General MacArthur had been laid on his bed. After making a last examination, Armstrong left the room and came downstairs. He found the others assembled in the drawing room. Miss Brent was knitting. Vera Claythorne was standing by the window looking out at the hissing rain. Bloor was sitting squarely in a chair, his hands on his knees. Lombard was walking restlessly up and down. At the far end of the room, Mr. Justice Wargrave was sitting in a grandfather chair. His eyes were half closed. They opened as the doctor came into the room. He said in a clear, penetrating voice,
"Well, doctor?"
Armstrong was very pale. He said, "No question of heart failure or anything like that. MacArthur was hit with a life preserver or some such thing on the back of the head." A little murmur went round, but the clear voice of the judge was raised once more.
"Did you find the actual weapon used?"
"No."
"Nevertheless, you are sure of your facts?"
"I am quite sure." Mr. Justice Wargrave said quietly,
"We know now exactly where we are."
There was no doubt now who was in charge of the situation. This morning, Wargrave had sat huddled in his chair on the terrace, refraining from any overt activity. Now he assumed command with the ease born of a long habit of authority. He definitely presided over the court. Clearing his throat, he once more spoke.
"This morning, gentlemen, whilst I was sitting on the terrace, I was an observer of your activities. There could be little doubt of your purpose. You were searching the island for an unknown murderer."
"Quite right, sir," said Philip Lombard.
The judge went on.
"You had come, doubtless, to the same conclusion that I had, namely that the deaths of Anthony Marston and Mrs. Rogers were neither accidental nor were they suicides. No doubt you also reached a certain conclusion as to the purpose of Mr. Owen in enticing us to this island."
Bloor said hoarsely,
"He's a madman, a loony."
The judge coughed.
"That almost certainly. But it hardly affects the issue. Our main preoccupation is this, to save our lives."
Armstrong said in a trembling voice, "There's no one on the island, I tell you, no one." The judge stroked his jaw. He said gently,
"In the sense you mean, no. I came to that conclusion early this morning. I could have told you that your search would be fruitless. Nevertheless, I am strongly of the opinion that Mr. Owen, to give him the name he himself has adopted, is on the island. Very much so. Given the scheme in question, which is neither more nor less than the execution of justice upon certain individuals for offences which the law cannot touch, there is only one way in which that scheme could be accomplished. Mr. Owen could only come to the island in one way. It is perfectly clear. Mr. Owen is one of us."
"Oh, no, no, no."
It was Vera who burst out almost in a moan. The judge turned a keen eye on her. He said,
"My dear young lady, this is no time for refusing to look facts in the face. We are all in grave danger. One of us is U.N. Owen, and we do not know which of us. Of the 10 people who came to this island, 3 are definitely cleared. Anthony Marston, Mrs. Rogers, and General MacArthur have gone beyond suspicion. There are 7 of us left. Of those 7, one is, if I may so express myself, a bogus little soldier boy.
He paused and looked round.
Do I take it that you all agree?
Armstrong said, It's fantastic, but I suppose you're right. Blore said, Not a doubt of it, and if you ask me, I've a very good idea. A quick gesture of Mr. Justice Wargrave's hand stopped him. The judge said quietly,
We will come to that presently. At the moment, all I wish to establish is that we are in agreement on the facts.
Emily Brent, still knitting, said,
Your argument seems logical. I agree that one of us is possessed by a devil.
Vera murmured, I can't believe it. I can't. Wargrave said,
Lombard.
I agree, sir, absolutely.
The judge nodded his head in a satisfied manner. He said,
Now, let us examine the evidence. To begin with, is there any reason for suspecting one particular person? Mr. Blore, you have, I think, something to say?
Blore was breathing hard. He said,
Lombard's got a revolver.
He didn't tell the truth last night. He admits it. Philip Lombard smiled scornfully. He said, I suppose I'd better explain again. He did so, telling the story briefly and succinctly. Blore said sharply, What's to prove it? There's nothing to corroborate your story. The judge coughed.
Unfortunately, he said, we are all in that position. There is only our own word to go upon.
He leaned forward.
You have none of you yet grasped what a very peculiar situation this is. To my mind, there is only one course of procedure to adopt. Is there anyone whom we can definitely eliminate from suspicion on the evidence which is in our possession?
Dr. Armstrong said quickly, I am a well-known professional man. The mere idea that I can be suspected of... Again, a gesture of the judge's hand arrested a speaker before he finished his speech. Mr. Justice Wargrave said in his small, clear voice,
I, too, am a well-known person, but, my dear sir, that proves less than nothing. Doctors have gone mad before now. Judges have gone mad. So, he added, looking at Blore, have policemen.
Lombard said, At any rate, I suppose you'll leave the women out of it. The judge's eyebrows rose. He said in the famous acid tones that counsel knew so well,
Do I understand you to assert that women are not subject to homicidal mania?
Lombard said irritably, Of course not, but all the same, it hardly seems possible. He stopped. Mr. Justice Wargrave, still in the same thin, sour voice, addressed Armstrong,
I take it, Dr. Armstrong, that a woman would have been physically capable of striking the blow that killed poor MacArthur?
The doctor said calmly, Perfectly capable, given a suitable instrument, such as a rubber truncheon or cosh.
It would require no undue exertion of force?
Not at all. Mr. Justice Wargrave wriggled his tortoise-like neck. He said,
The other 2 deaths have resulted from the administration of drugs. That, no one will dispute, is easily compassed by a person of the smallest physical strength.
Vera cried angrily,
I think you're mad!
His eyes turned slowly till they rested on her. It was the dispassionate stare of a man well used to weighing humanity in the balance. She thought,
He's just seeing me as a specimen, and
the thought came to her with real surprise.
He doesn't like me much.
In a measured tone, the judge was saying,
My dear young lady, do try and restrain your feelings. I am not accusing you.
He bowed to Miss Brent.
I hope, Miss Brent, that you are not offended by my insistence that all of us are equally under suspicion.
Emily Brent was knitting. She did not look up. In a cold voice, she said,
The idea that I should be accused of taking a fellow creature's life, not to speak of the lives of three fellow creatures, is, of course, quite absurd to anyone who knows anything of my character. But I quite appreciate the fact that we are all strangers to one another, and that, in those circumstances, nobody can be exonerated without the fullest proof. There is, as I have said, a devil amongst us.
The judge said, "Then we are agreed. There can be no elimination on the ground of character or position alone."
Lombard said, "What about Rogers?" The judge looked at him unblinkingly.
"What about him?"
Lombard said, "Well, to my mind, Rogers seems pretty well ruled out."
Mr. Justice Wargrave said,
"Indeed, and on what grounds?"
Lombard said, "He hasn't got the brains, for one thing, and for another, his wife was one of the victims."
The judge's heavy eyebrows rose once more. He said,
"In my time, young man, several people have come before me accused of the murders of their wives, and have been found guilty."
"Oh, I agree. Wife murder is perfectly possible. Almost natural, let's say. But not this particular kind. I can believe in Rogers killing his wife because he was scared of her breaking down and giving him away, or because he'd taken a dislike to her, or because he wanted to link up with some nice little bit rather less long in the tooth. But I can't see him as the lunatic Mr. Owen, dealing out crazy justice and starting on his own wife for a crime they both committed."
Mr. Justice Wargrave said,
"You are assuming hearsay to be evidence. We do not know that Rogers and his wife conspired to murder their employer. That may have been a false statement, made so that Rogers should appear to be in the same position as ourselves. Mrs. Rogers' terror last night may have been due to the fact that she realized her husband was mentally unhinged."
Lombard said, "Well, have it your own way. UN Owen is one of us. No exceptions allowed. We all qualify."
Mr. Justice Wargrave said,
"My point is that there can be no exceptions allowed on the score of character, position, or probability. What we must now examine is the possibility of eliminating one or more persons on the facts. To put it simply, is there among us one or more persons who could not possibly have administered either cyanide to Anthony Marston or an overdose of sleeping draught to Mrs. Rogers, or who had no opportunity of striking the blow that killed General MacArthur?"
Blore's rather heavy face lit up. He leant forward.
"Now you're talking, sir," he said. "That's the stuff. Let's go into it. As regards young Marston, I don't think there's anything to be done. It's already been suggested that someone from outside slipped something into the dregs of his glass before he refilled it for the last time. A person actually in the room could have done that even more easily. I can't remember if Rogers was in the room, but any of the rest of us could certainly have done it."
He paused, then went on.
"Now, take the woman, Rogers. The people who stand out there are her husband and the doctor. Either of them could have done it as easy as winking."
Armstrong sprang to his feet. He was trembling.
"I protest. This is absolutely uncalled for. I swear that the dose I gave the woman was perfectly—"
"Dr. Armstrong,"
the small, sour voice was compelling. The doctor stopped with a jerk in the middle of his sentence. The small, cold voice went on,
"Your indignation is very natural. Nevertheless, you must admit that the facts have got to be faced. Either you or Rogers could have administered a fatal dose with the greatest ease. Let us now consider the position of the other people present. What chance had I? Had Inspector Blore? Had Miss Brent? Had Miss Claythorne? Had Mr. Lombard of administering poison? Can any one of us be completely and entirely eliminated?"
He paused.
"I think not."
Vera said angrily,
"I was nowhere near the woman. All of you can swear to that."
Mr. Justice Wargrave waited a minute, then he said,
"As far as my memory tells me, the facts were these. Will anyone please correct me if I make a misstatement? Mrs. Rogers was lifted onto the sofa by Anthony Marston and Mr. Lombard, and Dr. Armstrong went to her. He sent Rogers for brandy. There was then a question raised as to where the voice we had just heard had come from. We all went into the next room, with the exception of Miss Brent, who remained in this room, alone with the unconscious woman.
A spot of colour came into Emily Brent's cheeks. She stopped knitting. She said,
"This is outrageous."
The remorseless small voice went on,
"When we returned to this room, you, Miss Brent, were bending over the woman on the sofa."
Emily Brent said,
"Is common humanity a criminal offence?"
Mr. Justice Wargrave said,
"I am only establishing facts." Rogers then entered the room with the brandy, which, of course, he could quite well have doctored before entering the room. The brandy was administered to the woman, and shortly afterwards her husband and Dr. Armstrong assisted her up to bed, where Dr. Armstrong gave her a sedative.
Blore said, "That's what happened, absolutely, and that lets out the judge, Mr. Lombard, myself, and Miss Claythorne." His voice was loud and jubilant. Mr. Justice Wargrave, bringing a cold eye to bear upon him, murmured,
"Ah, but does it? We must take into account every possible eventuality."
Blore stared. He said, "I don't get you." Mr. Justice Wargrave said,
"Upstairs in her room, Mrs. Rogers is lying in bed. The sedative that the doctor has given her begins to take effect. She is vaguely sleepy and acquiescent. Supposing that at that moment there is a tap on the door and someone enters bringing her, shall we say, a tablet or a draught with the message that the doctor says you ought to take this. Do you imagine for one minute that she would not have swallowed it obediently without thinking twice about it?"
There was a silence. Blore shifted his feet and frowned. Philip Lombard said, "I don't believe in that story for a minute. Besides, none of us left this room for hours afterwards. There was Marston's death and all the rest of it." The judge said,
"Someone could have left his or her bedroom later."
Lombard objected.
"But then Rogers would have been up there."
Dr. Armstrong stirred. "No," he said. "Rogers went downstairs to clear up in the dining room and pantry. Anyone could have gone up to the woman's bedroom then without being seen."
Emily Brent said, "Surely, Doctor, the woman would have been fast asleep by then, under the influence of the drug you had administered."
"In all likelihood, yes, but it's not a certainty. Until you have prescribed for a patient more than once, you cannot tell their reaction to different drugs. There is, sometimes, a considerable period before a sedative takes effect. It depends on the personal idiosyncrasy of the patient towards that particular drug."
Lombard said,
"Of course you would say that, Doctor. Suits your book, eh?"
Again Armstrong's face darkened with anger. But again that passionless, cold little voice stopped the words on his lips.
"No good result can come from recrimination. Facts are what we have to deal with. It is established, I think, that there is a possibility of such a thing as I've outlined occurring. I agree that its probability value is not high, though there again it depends on who that person might have been. The appearance of Miss Brent or of Miss Claythorne on such an errand would have occasioned no surprise in the patient's mind. I agree that the appearance of myself or of Mr. Blore or of Mr. Lombard would have been, to say the least of it, unusual, but I still think the visit would have been received without the awakening of any real suspicion."
Blore said,
"And that gets us where?"
Mr. Justice Wargrave, stroking his lip and looking quite passionless and inhuman, said,
"We have now dealt with the second killing, and have established the fact that no one of us can be completely exonerated from suspicion."
He paused and went on.
"We come now to the death of General MacArthur. That took place this morning. I will ask anyone who considers that he or she has an alibi to state it in so many words. I myself will state at once that I have no valid alibi. I spent the morning sitting on the terrace and meditating on the singular position in which we all find ourselves. I sat on that chair on the terrace for the whole morning until the gong went. But there were, I should imagine, several periods during the morning when I was quite unobserved, and during which it would have been possible for me to walk down to the sea, kill the general, and return to my chair. There is only my word for the fact that I never left the terrace. In the circumstances, that is not enough. There must be proof.
Blore said, I was with Mr. Lombard and Dr. Armstrong all the morning. They'll bear me out.
Dr. Armstrong said, you went to the house for a rope.
Blore said, of course I did. Went straight there and straight back. You know I did.
Armstrong said, you were a long time.
Blore turned crimson. He said, what the hell do you mean by that, Dr. Armstrong?
Armstrong repeated, I only said you were a long time.
Had to find it, didn't I? Can't lay your hands on a coil of rope all in a minute.
Mr. Justice Wargrave said,
during Inspector Blore's absence, were you two gentlemen together?
Armstrong said hotly, certainly.
That is, Lombard went off for a few minutes. I remained where I was.
Lombard said with a smile,
I wanted to test the possibilities of heliographing to the mainland. Wanted to find the best spot. I was only absent a minute or two.
Armstrong nodded. He said, that's right. Not long enough to do a murder, I assure you.
The judge said, did either of you two glance at your watches?
Well, no.
Philip Lombard said, I wasn't wearing one.
The judge said evenly,
a minute or two is a vague expression.
He turned his head to the upright figure with the knitting lying on her lap.
Miss Brent?
Emily Brent said, I took a walk with Miss Claythorne up to the top of the island. Afterwards, I sat on the terrace in the sun.
The judge said,
I don't think I noticed you there.
No, I was round the corner of the house to the east. It was out of the wind there.
And you sat there till lunchtime?
Yes.
Miss Claythorne?
Vera answered readily and clearly. I was with Miss Brent early this morning. After that, I wandered about a bit. Then I went down and talked to General MacArthur.
Mr. Justice Wargrave interrupted. He said,
what time was that?
Vera, for the first time, was vague. She said, I don't know. About an hour before lunch, I think. Or it might have been less.
Blore asked, was it after we'd spoken to him or before?
Vera said, I don't know. He was very queer.
She shivered.
In what way was he queer?
The judge wanted to know. Vera said in a low voice, he said we were all going to die. He said he was waiting for the end. He frightened me.
The judge nodded. He said,
what did you do next?
I went back to the house. Then, just before lunch, I went out again and up behind the house. I've been terribly restless all day.
Mr. Justice Wargrave stroked his chin. He said,
there remains Rogers, though I doubt if his evidence will add anything to our sum of knowledge.
Rogers, summoned before the court, had very little to tell. He had been busy all the morning about household duties and with the preparation of lunch. He had taken cocktails onto the terrace before lunch, and had then gone up to remove his things from the attic to another room. He had not looked out of the window during the morning, and had seen nothing that could have any bearing upon the death of General MacArthur. He would swear definitely that there had been 8 china figures upon the dining table when he laid the table for lunch. At the conclusion of Roger's evidence, there was a pause. Mr. Justice Wargrave cleared his throat. Lombard murmured to Vera Claythorne,
the summing up will now take place.
The judge said,
we have inquired into the circumstances of these 3 deaths to the best of our ability. Whilst probability in some cases is against certain people being implicated, yet we cannot say definitely that any one person can be considered as cleared of all complicity. I reiterate my positive belief that of the 7 persons assembled in this room, 1 is a dangerous and probably insane criminal. There is no evidence before us as to who that person is. All we can do at the present juncture is to consider what measures we can take for communicating with the mainland for help, and in the event of help being delayed, as is only too possible given the state of the weather, what measures we must adopt to ensure our safety. I would ask you all to consider this carefully, and to give me any suggestions that may occur to you. In the meantime, I warn everybody to be upon his or her guard. So far, the murderer has had an easy task, since his victims have been unsuspicious. From now on, it is our task to suspect each and every one amongst us. Forewarned is forearmed. Take no risks, and be alert to danger. That is all.
Philip Lombard murmured beneath his breath, "The court will now adjourn." Chapter 10.
"Do you believe it?" Vera asked.
She and Philip Lombard sat on the windowsill of the living room. Outside, the rain poured down and the wind howled in great shuddering gusts against the window panes. Philip Lombard cocked his head slightly on one side before answering. Then he said, "You mean, do I believe that old Wargrave is right when he says it's one of us?"
"Yes."
Philip Lombard said slowly, "It's difficult to say. Logically, you know, he's right, and yet..." Vera took the words out of his mouth.
"And yet it seems so incredible."
Philip Lombard made a grimace. "The whole thing's incredible. But after MacArthur's death, there's no more doubt as to one thing. There's no question now of accidents or suicides. It's definitely murder. 3 murders up to date." Vera shivered. She said,
"It's like some awful dream. I keep feeling that things like this can't happen."
He said with understanding, "I know. Presently a tap will come on the door and early morning tea will be brought in." Vera said,
"Oh, how I wish that could happen."
Philip Lombard said gravely, "Yes, but it won't. We're all in the dream, and we've got to be pretty much upon our guard from now on." Vera said, lowering.
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.